One of the things that made the Black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the Black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you have never had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us are sitting at the same table, are all of us diners? I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You've got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistles. But you have not enjoyed the fruits. No, sir. You have fought harder for the fruits than the white man had. You have worked harder for the fruits than the white man had. But you've enjoyed less. You, when the man put the uniform on you and sent you abroad, you fought harder than they did. Yeah, I know you. When you're fighting for them, you can fight. The Black Muslim movement did make that contribution. They made the whole civil rights movement become more militant and more acceptable to the white power structure. He would rather have them than us. In fact, I think we forced many of the civil rights leaders to be even more militant than they intended. I know some of them who get out there and boom, 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 and don't mean it, because they round back in their corner as soon as the action comes. John F. Kennedy also saw that it was necessary for a new approach among the American Negroes. And during his entire term in office, he specialized in how to psycho the American Negro. Now, a lot of y'all don't like my saying this, but I wouldn't ever take a stand on that if I didn't know what I was talking about. And I don't, by living in this kind of society, pretty much around them, and you know what I mean when I say them, I learned to study them, and you can think that they mean you some good oftentimes, and if you look at it a little closer, you'll see that they don't mean you any good. That doesn't mean there aren't some of them who mean good, but it does mean that most of them don't mean good. Kennedy's new approach was pretending to go along with us in our struggle for civil rights and different other forms of rights. But I remember the expose that Look magazine did on Meredith's situation in Mississippi. And Look magazine did an expose showing that Robert Kennedy and Governor Wallace, not Governor Wallace, Governor Barnett, had made a deal wherein the Attorney General was going to come down and try and force Meredith into school, and Barnett was going to stand at the door, you know, and say, no, you can't come in. And he was going to get in anyway. But it was all arranged in advance. And then Barnett was supposed to keep the support of the white races because that's who he's holding up. And Kennedy would keep the support of the Negroes because that's who he'd be holding up. And I say, and it was a cut and dry deal. And it's not a secret. It was written. They write about it. But now, if that's a deal and that's a deal, how many other deals do you think go down? What you think is on the level is crookeder, brothers and sisters, than a pretzel, which is most crooked. So in my conclusion, I would like to point out that the approach that was used by the administration right on up until today, even the present generation, was designed skillfully to make it appear that they were trying to solve the problem when they actually weren't. They would deal with the condition, but never the cause. They only gave us tokenism. Tokenism benefits only a few. It never benefits the masses. And the masses are the ones who have the problem, not the few. That one who benefits from tokenism, he doesn't want to be around us anyway. That's why he picks up on the token. You ever notice how some Negroes will brag, I'm the only one out there. I'm the only one on my job. Don't you hear him say that? Yes, you ought to punch him in his... No, he's your brother. You shouldn't punch your brother. But you should really yell. You can punch him with some words. You should, whenever you see a Negro bragging about, he's the only one in this neighborhood. He's bragging. And he's telling you, in essence, I'm surrounded by white folks, you know. I love them and they love me. Oh, yes, and on his job, I'm the only one on my job. I've been listening to that stuff all my life. And the generation that's coming up, they're not going to be saying that. The generation that's coming up, everybody's going to look like an Uncle Tom to them. And you and I have to learn that in time so that we don't pose that image when our people, when our young generation come up and begin to look at us. The masses of our people still have bad housing, bad schooling, and inferior jobs, jobs that don't compensate with sufficient salary for them to carry on their life in this world. So that the problem for the masses has gone absolutely unsolved. And the only one for whom it has been solved are people like Whitney Young, who's supposed to be placed in the cabinet, so the rumors say. He'll be one of the first black cabinet men, and that answers where he's at. And others who have been given jobs, Carl Rowan, who was put over the USIS, who is very skillfully trying to make Africans think that the problem of the black man in this country is all solved. And this is the worst thing the white man can do to himself, is to take one of these kind of Negroes and ask him, how do your people feel, boy? And he's going to tell that man that we are satisfied. And that's what they do, brothers and sisters. So they get behind the door and tell the white man we're satisfied. Just keep me up here in front of them, boss, and I'll keep them behind you. That's what they talk when they're behind closed doors. Because, see, the white man doesn't go along with anybody who's not for him. He doesn't care whether you're for right or wrong. He wants to know, are you for him? And if you're for him, he doesn't care what else you're for, as long as you're for him. Then he puts you up over the Negro community. You become the spokesman. And in your struggle, it's like standing on a revolving wheel. You're running, but you're not going anywhere. You run faster and faster, and the wheel just goes faster and faster. You never leave the spot that you're standing in. So it is very important to see that the only way that our problem is going to be solved, it has to be with a solution that will benefit the masses, not these upper class, so-called upper class. Actually, there's no such thing as a upper class Negro, because he gets the same hell as the other class Negro. All of them get the same hell, which is one of the things that's good about this racist system. It makes us all one. Quickly, if you'll notice, in 1963, everyone was talking about the centennial of progress. I think that's what they called it. 100 years since the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and everyone to celebrate how much white and black people have learned to love each other in America. You probably remember how they were talking in January of 1963. Well, if you had stood up in January at the same time that they were talking all this talk about a good year ahead, good things ahead, and told them that by May, Birmingham would have exploded and Bull Connor would be known as an international thug for the brutality that he heaped upon black people. If you would tell the people in January of 63 that John F. Kennedy would be killed for his role in everything. If you had told them in January that Medgar Evers would be murdered and nobody able to bring his killer to justice, or if you were to have told them in January of 1963 that a church would be bombed in Birmingham with four little black girls blown to bits while they were praying and serving Jesus, why, they would say you're crazy. In 1964, they started out the same way. That was the year of promise. If you were to have told them while they were talking about this great year of promise ahead, you know, civil rights and all of that, what was coming, that before long, three civil rights workers would be brutally murdered and the government unable to do anything about it. A Negro educator in Georgia brutally murdered in broad daylight, and the men who did it be known and the government not able to do anything about it. If you had said this in January of 64, they'd say you were not. Now they're starting out in 1965 the same way, talking about the Great Society, you know, anti-poverty. If you tell them right now what is in store for 1965, they'll think you crazy for sure. But 1965 will be the longest and hottest and bloodiest year of them all. And it has to be. Not because you want it to be, or I want it to be, or we want it to be, but because the conditions that that created these explosions in 1963 are still here. The conditions that created explosions in 64 are still here. You can't say that you're not going to have an explosion and you leave the condition. The ingredients are still here. And as long as those ingredients, explosive ingredients, remain, then you're going to have the potential for explosion on your hands. And brothers and sisters, let me say, I spend my time out there in the street with people, all kind of people, listening to what they have to say. And they're dissatisfied. They're disillusioned. They're fed up. They're getting to the point of frustration where they are beginning to feel, what do they have to lose? And when you get to that point, you're the type of person who can create a very dangerously explosive atmosphere. This is what's happening in our neighborhoods to our people. I read in a poll taken by Newsweek magazine this week saying that Negroes are satisfied. Oh yes, poll, you know, in Newsweek, supposed to be a top magazine with a top poster, talking about how satisfied Negroes are. Maybe I haven't met the Negroes he met. Because I know he hasn't met the ones that I've met. But this is dangerous. This is where the white man does himself the most harm. He invents statistics to create an image, thinking that that image is going to hold things in check. You know why they always say Negroes are lazy? Because they want Negroes to be lazy. They always say Negroes can't unite because they don't want Negroes to unite. And once they put this thing in the mind, they feel that the Negro gets that into him and he tries to fulfill that image. If you say you can't unite him, and then you come to him to unite him, he won't unite because it's been said that he's not supposed to unite. It's a cycle that they work, and it's the same way with these statistics. When they think that an explosive era is coming up, then they grab their press again and begin to shower the Negro public to make it appear that all Negroes are satisfied. And because if you know that you're dissatisfied all by yourself and 10 others aren't, you play it cool. But you know if all 10 of you are satisfied, you get with it. Well, this is what the man knows. The man knows that if these Negroes find out how dissatisfied they really are, and all of them, even Uncle Tom is dissatisfied, he's just playing his part for now. And this is what makes them frightened. It frightens them in France, it frightens them in England, and it frightens them in the United States. And it is for this reason that it is so important for you and me to start organizing among ourselves intelligently and try to find out what are we going to do if this happens, that happens, or the next thing happens. Don't think that you're just going to run to the man and say, look, boss, this is me. Why, when the deal goes down, you look just like me in his eyesight. I'll make it tough for you. Yes, when the deal goes down, he doesn't look at you in any better light than he looks at me. I was on a television program in New York last week. One of the liberals did a takeoff on James Farmer. Now, here's James Farmer teaching Negroes to be nonviolent and loving and all that. Why, they should be patting him on the back. And instead of them patting him on the back, they want to knock at him, and it put me in a position of having to defend him. And I wish I did. I was glad to, because I wanted to crack this man's neck anyway. And mentally, so that rather I should say intellectually. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. There is a situation where I have been maneuvered right now between me and the black Muslim movement, something that I really deeply regret, because I don't think anything is more destructive than two groups of black people fighting each other. But something that can't be avoided, because it goes deep down beneath the surface, and these things will come up in the very near future. If you I might say this before I sit down. If you recall, when I left the black Muslim movement, I stated clearly that it wasn't my intention to even continue to be aware that they existed, but that I was going to spend my time working in the non-Muslim community. But they were fearful that if they didn't do something, that perhaps many of those who were in the mosque would leave it and follow a different direction. So they had to start doing a takeoff on me, plus they had to try and silence me because of what they know that I know. And I should think that they should know me well enough to know that they certainly can't frighten me. But when it does come to the light, excuse me for keep coughing like that, but I got some of that smoke last night. But if there are some things involving the black Muslim movement, which when they come to light, you will be shocked. The thing that you have to understand where those of us in the black Muslim movement were concerned, all of us believed 100% in the divinity of Elijah Muhammad. We believed in him. We actually believed that God had taught him, right here in Detroit, by the way, that God had taught him and all of that. And I always thought that he believed it himself. And I was shocked when I found out that he himself didn't believe it. And when that shock reached me, then I began to look everywhere else and try to get a better understanding of the things that confront all of us so that we can get together in some kind of way to offset it. I want to thank you for coming out this afternoon, this evening. I think it's wonderful that as many of you came out, considering the blackout on the meeting that took place. Also, and the brothers who are here are very progressive young men, and I would advise all of you to get with them in every way that you can to try and create some kind of united effort toward common goals, common objectives, and don't let the power structure maneuver you into a time-wasting battle with others when you could be involved in something that's constructive and getting a real job done. One thing I should have pointed out to you that once we formed our new organization, once we became identified with the Orthodox Muslim world, we also formed a group known as the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which is designed to fight all the negative political, economic, and social conditions that exist in our neighborhood. It's a non-religious organization to which anyone can belong who's interested in direct action. And one of our first programs is to take our problem out of the civil rights context and place it at the international level of human rights so that the entire world can have a voice. We keep it civil rights, then the only place we can turn for allies is within the domestic confines of America. But when you make it a human rights struggle, it becomes international. And then you can open the door for all types of advice and support from our brothers in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and elsewhere. So it's very, very important. That's our international aim. And that's our external aim. Our internal aim is to become immediately involved in a mass voters registration drive, but we don't believe in voter registration without voter education. We believe that our people should be educated into the science of politics so that they will know what a vote is for, what a vote is supposed to produce, and also how to utilize this united voting power to so that you can control the politics of your own community and the politicians that represent that community. We're for that. And in that line, we will work with all other, even the civil rights groups, who are dedicated to increase the number of black registered voters in the South. The only area in which we differ with them is this. We don't believe that young students should be sent into Mississippi, Alabama, and these other places without some kind of protection. So we will join in with them in their voter registration and help to train brothers in the arts that are necessary in this day and age to enable one to continue his existence upon this earth. I say that again that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in forcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also. We're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.